It's nice to be back with you. My wife and I just spent the last week in Oahu, Hawaii, and there's nothing like a trip to Oahu to make you think about church planting, but we're glad to be back and among you, and it's wonderful to see you all. And we're in the book of Colossians still. We're just a few weeks in now. You can head to Colossians chapter 1. We're still in chapter 1, 4 weeks in. Encourage you to go to betheltab.ca and catch up if you've missed any of the sermons in this series. But we're in Colossians 1, starting in verse 15 today. I want to take you to take a look at this image on the screen. Tell me what you see. Nike, the Nike swoosh, right? You all know this isn't just a check mark. You know that this is a symbol, this is a logo, this is an image of a brand, right? And what do you think of when you see this swoosh? Running. Anything else? Jordan, yeah. We think of athletics, we think of sports, we think of running. Let's look at the next image. What's this one? Apple. It's not just an Apple, right? This is Apple computers. Right? So what do you think of when you see this apple with a bite out of it? Video games, computers, technology, right? Steve Jobs, iPhones. One more. What's this one? A little harder. Amazon. We know this one. It's just an A with a little smiley face, point, you know, arrow under it. But we know that this is the symbol of a brand. And what do you think of when you think of this A? Shopping, right? Online shopping and all the things that you bought online through Amazon, right? Now, the amazing thing about these images is that they aren't just a swoosh. You didn't just see an apple. You didn't just see an A with a little smiley arrow underneath it. You saw all of the meaning and all of the identity and all of your personal, emotional, and physical experiences that are attached to those symbols. For years, Nike has been putting that symbol in front of you on their athletic apparel, on their commercials, and they've been telling stories. And now every time that symbol gets shown to your eyes, all of those stories, all of that meaning, all of your personal experiences flood in, and it's just that image that helps Nike reveal themselves, right? An image or a logo is the self-expression, the self-revelation of a company or of a brand. Now, Nike and Apple and Amazon, they didn't come up with this idea. God came up with this idea. They didn't come up with the idea of an image representing them. God came up with an image representing them. He created the universe, and he created the world, and he created a garden. And in the middle of the garden, the pinnacle of his creation, he created male and female. It says in Genesis 1, 27 and 28, in the image of God, he created them. And what that means is that man and woman, humanity, are meant to represent God. That when creation looks at humanity, that when humans look at each other, we are supposed to see all of the meaning and all of the stories and all of the self-revelation of God through the image that he put in front of us. But as we'll get into a little bit more today, something terrible happened. And that image has been distorted. That image has been broken. So now when the image of God shows up, often the wrong message is conveyed. The wrong meaning. False stories are displayed. And as a result, God is often rejected and misunderstood. But that's what Jesus came to fix. He came to restore the image of God by being the perfect, true image of God himself. So we get into Colossians here, and this is really the major theme of Colossians 1, starting in verse 15. We'll read it together. You have a Bible in front of you maybe, and it'll be on the screen if you don't, starting in verse 15 of Colossians 1. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. This passage is considered one of the most important passages in the New Testament when it comes to understanding who Jesus is, what he has done, and how we can relate to him, and through him, how we can relate to God. The theological term for our study and understanding of who Jesus is and what he's done is Christology, Christology, right? When we study organisms, we study biology. When we study the mind, we study psychology. When we try to understand Christ, it's called Christology. And so this is one of the most important and rich Christological passages in the entire Bible. And it's very important that we understand its themes and what it's trying to say to us. So as we've seen in this series, Paul begins his letter by introducing himself, orienting the Colossian church as to where they are and what God is doing in them. He's thankful for what God is doing in them. He's praying for them. And then he slows right down with these few verses here. And verse 15 to 20 is actually a poem. He's slowed down, he's changed the genre, and he's actually reciting a poem. It's unclear whether this was written by Paul. He may have written it just for the Colossians, or maybe he's quoting it from other scholars and writers who wrote this in the early church, or maybe he's repurposed it and rewritten it. But either way, this is poetic language, and the reason a writer like Paul would do that, he would shift from his prayer and his thankfulness, he would shift this poem is to slow down and say, listen to this. This is important. I'm changing gears here. I want you to slow down and take a look at what's in these next few lines. It's a challenging passage to understand. It's very difficult. It's very hard to write this sermon, to be honest. You know, Peter, one of Jesus' closest friends who spent 3 years physically with Jesus, he writes in one of his letters to a church, he says, Paul writes some stuff that is really hard to understand. Right? That's Peter. So if you and I have a little trouble grasping this on our first reading, we're in good company. And so I'm going to try my best to scratch the surface of the depth of theology and the depth of meaning that's found in this passage. What I'd like to do actually to start, many of you may be familiar with Eugene Peterson's work, and he translated or paraphrased the Bible in what he called the Message. And it's not a scholarly translation, but it's a helpful kind of contemporary language Bible that is nice for maybe devotions or something like that. So I actually want to read this passage in the Message version because it helps bring some images that might connect and help us understand it a bit better. So back to Colossians 1, 15 to 20. We look at this Son and see the God who cannot be seen. We look at this Son and see God's original purpose in everything created. For everything, absolutely everything above and below, visible and invisible, rank after rank after rank of angels, everything got started in him and finds its purpose in him. He was there before any of it came into existence and holds it all together right up to this moment. And when it comes to the church, he organizes and holds it together like the head does a body. He was supreme in the beginning, and leading the resurrection parade, he is supreme in the end. From beginning to end, he's there, towering far above everything, everyone. So spacious is he, so roomy, that everything of God finds its proper place in him without crowding. Not only that, but all the broken and dislocated pieces of the universe, people and things, animals and atoms get properly fixed and fit together in vibrant harmonies, all because of his death, his blood that poured down from the cross. As you can see, this passage is so deep and rich, but I think we can sum it up in one statement that I'll explain for the rest of the morning. The statement is this: God, humanity, and the world are to be understood through Jesus. God, humanity, and the world are to be understood through Jesus. If we don't have a clear picture of Jesus, we'll never understand God. If we don't have a clear picture of Jesus, we'll never understand humanity, our own humanity, or the humanity that surrounds us. And if we don't have a clear picture of Jesus, we'll never understand the world that he created and we live in. He is the lens through which we can see all of these things clearly. Do you remember when you were a kid and there would be a solar eclipse and you were told by your parents or your teachers, don't look directly at it. It'll burn your eyes, right? And so you made those pinhole cameras. You got a shoebox, you put a little hole in it, and there was like a mirror reflection thing in there. And so you could look through that and you could see a clear image of the sun without it burning your eyes. That's kind of what we're talking about when we're talking about Jesus. We get a distorted and dangerous view of God, humanity, and the world if we don't use Jesus as our mirror, as the to create the right angle and the right lens in which to see. Or it's kind of like watching a 3D movie without the 3D glasses. You ever tried that? Sometimes I pull them down just to see what's going on without the 3D effect. And it's distorted, it's grainy, it's discolored. You don't get the depth of imagery. And what can happen when you are not looking at it 3D is you'll miss stuff. You'll misunderstand what's going on. You'll miss something that's going on in the image and misinterpret the movie. And fallen humanity is like being two-dimensional in a world that was supposed to be three-dimensional. And we misinterpret what's around us. We misinterpret God. We misinterpret ourselves and other humans. We misinterpret the world and come to false conclusions because we don't have the right lens. And so Jesus provides the right lens through which to see God, humanity, and the world in all its depth, in all its reality, and all its richness. So God, humanity, and the world to be understood through Jesus. First of all, God. Jesus makes the invisible God visible. Jesus is not just a mere great man or a prophet, but he is God who descended from heaven, put on flesh to live a human life among us. He physically came to show the world who God is. He put flesh on to be among us. Verse 15 says, the Son is the image of the invisible God. The Message version we read says, look at this Son and see the God who cannot be seen. Now this word image is very important. And what Paul is doing here, and anytime you see this language, what you're being told to do is think back all the way to Genesis 1 to the beginning where the first time the image of God is talked about. And I quoted it a little bit earlier, but Genesis 1, 27 to 28 says this, God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. This passage reflects the identity and purpose of humankind. That we are the image of God. That's our identity. We reflect him. We look like God. Not that God has four limbs and a nose and ears, but something of our nature, something of our character and our characteristics actually reflects God. We're like a mirror that the world looks into, and through us they see who God is. That's what it means to be the image of God. And our purpose as well, God says to humanity, be fruitful and rule the earth, which means that we are stewards of God's creation. He created it, he's in charge of it, but he put humanity on earth. He put them in a garden and said, make the rest of the earth as beautiful and lovely and peaceful and amazing as this garden, and be my stewards and rule here as my representatives. That's our identity and that's our purpose. But what happened is we decided we knew better. And we tried to rule the world under our terms. And we rebelled against God and we did it a different way, and sin entered into the world. But sin is not merely defined as just doing something that's morally wrong. Sin can be better defined as actually missing out and walking away from our intended purpose. It's abdicating our responsibility to wisely rule creation as God intended us to. It's about submitting to creation rather than submitting to Creator. And as a result, everything gets turned upside down. Here's one way to look at it. God said to humanity, here's the world I created, and I'm putting you here to represent me to all creation, so that when creation looks at you and when other humans look at you, they will see me. They'll see me reflected through you. And he said, so rule in my stead. Here's how it works. It's got to work like this. If you try it a different way, it's going to break, right? Just like anything. If you try driving a car with sawdust for gas, it's going to break, right? So here's how the world works. Rule in my stead and bring to the entire creation the kind of order and peace and beauty of God that you find in me. And humans said, great. And then we went off and said, you know what? God doesn't really know what he's talking about. We're going to do it our way. And Eve submitted to the suggestion of the snake. You ever think about that? Adam and Eve were supposed to submit to the leadership of God, yet the snake comes along and says, no, submit to my idea. The snake is a created being, a being that Adam and Eve were supposed to rule over and wisely govern. But instead, they did what the snake told them to do. And so what happens when humans invert the order of authority is all of creation begins to rebel, and all of creation begins to usurp the authority that we had to wisely rule and steward the world. And so everything's now in chaos. Tsunamis hit and cancer comes and earthquakes happen. And these things begin to come because the world is rebelling and taking a place that did not belong to them. So humanity has now been subject to the curse. God says to Adam, it's going to be much harder now when you try to garden. I gave you Eden and I said, make the rest of the world look like this. And now when you try, thorns are going to come up. It's going to rebel against you because you rebelled against me. He said to Eve, childbearing is going to be more difficult. Your children are going to rebel against you just like you rebelled against me because the created order has been inverted and creation is in rebellion now. So the world has been broken. Our image has been tainted. Humanity lost the image of God and lost the ability to represent him well and steward the world. But God had a solution. Verse 19 and 20, God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, Jesus, and through him to reconcile himself to all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Jesus comes to reconcile, to reorder, to bring chaos back into its original purpose. God sent Jesus, the image of the invisible, all of the fullness of God dwelling in him, which means Jesus is God in the flesh, representing him perfectly on earth. He came to do what humanity failed to do. He came to rule, to exercise authority, to bring peace, to bring order once again. This is one of the reasons Jesus had a healing ministry. He went around healing physical bodies as a way to represent the fact that he was coming to restore the image of God in humanity. And then when creation saw Jesus, they saw God, right? The wind and the waves in the stormy sea heard his voice saying, calm down, and it did. Why? Because Jesus was the true image of God who was made to rule, who was told to take care of, who was in charge of creation. So when his voice came out, creation listened because he was the true image of God. And he was coming to restore that in us. That's why when Jesus speaks to us, we should listen. And when we don't listen, we're only inviting disorder and chaos and brokenness into our lives. So how do we understand God through Jesus? If you want to know what God is like, look at Jesus. He is the perfect representation of God. He is all the fullness of God in bodily form. He is the image of God. And so when we see him, we see who God is. Secondly, Jesus helps us understand humanity because Jesus is the true human being. He's not only the God come in flesh, but he's also the perfect and true human being. We have this saying, we say, I'm only human, right? And we say this, why? Because we are flawed. We say this because we mess up. We say this after we've done something wrong. You know, we have all these weaknesses and someone calls us on it. You go, what did you expect? I'm only human. Right? Because we have this view of humanity that humanity is this broken and flawed species and you know, there's no way that we should be perfect. And so we say, hey, I'm just a human and humans are terrible. So I'm just being terrible like I'm supposed to be. But that's actually a flawed perspective based on an understanding of humanity after the image of God was broken. But humanity was never meant to be weak. Humanity was never meant to be broken. Humanity was never meant to be imperfect. God created Adam and Eve, put them in the garden, and said, it's very good. And it was only after sin came in the world that we have these flaws and weaknesses. But true humans live much differently than we do. True humans don't have the flaws that we have. It's only because the image has been broken that we have these flaws. We don't rule with wisdom, and when people see God, or when people see us, they don't see God for who he is. They see marred and scarred versions of who he is and come to wrong conclusions. See, when we fail to live up to our purpose, it's not because we're human. It's not because we're only human. It's because we've actually lost our humanity. It's because we're less than human when we fail and have weaknesses and make mistakes. Humans don't kill each other. Humans don't hate each other. Humans don't abuse and mistreat each other. Humans don't abuse and mistreat creation. Humans aren't selfish. Humans don't hoard when other people have a lack. That's not what humans were designed to do. These acts are perpetrated by a species that once was human but now is not. These acts are perpetrated by a species that is less than human. But Jesus came to restore our humanity by being the perfect, true version of humanity in himself, to show us what a human being can truly be like when they have been saved and redeemed from sin. So Paul says in verse 15, Jesus is the firstborn over all creation. And what he's saying is this: Jesus is the truest and best version of humanity that there is. Don't let the word firstborn confuse you. Some groups will try to tell you this means that Jesus was created first, but it's not supported in the text or anywhere else in the Bible. What it's talking about is his supremacy. The idea of being firstborn, especially in the ancient world, had everything to do with inheritance and supremacy and leadership and authority. And so Jesus, as verse 18 says, is supreme over all. He is Lord over all. That's what it means for him to be firstborn over all creation. He is the Lord of all creation. He is the best version of humanity that there is. When you want to see a pattern of what a human being should look like and could look like, you look at the greatest human who ever lived. We have great examples of humans in our history. We have men like Martin Luther King Jr. and Billy Graham, and women like Mother Teresa, and others like Terry Fox, and people who are worthy of imitation and worthy of honor, and they've done great things, and they've shown the power and the ability of the human spirit. But none of them holds a candle to the greatest human being who has ever lived, and that's Jesus Christ. He truly represents God's original design for what a human can look like. Verse 18 says, he's the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead. That's talking about our future resurrection, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. His status as firstborn is about being supreme. He's Lord over all. It says he's in charge of the church. So here's the cool thing. The church is the community of people in which Jesus is restoring our humanity. He's restoring us as his image. The Bible talks about us being the body of Christ. We are the image of Christ, so that when the world looks at the church, what should they see? They should see Jesus. They should see what humanity could and should be. They should look at the church and see the image of God. They should look at the church and say, God must be great. God must love us. God must be just. God must be good, because I see the people who represent him. Unfortunately, often people look at the church and say, God must be terrible. God must be judgmental. God must hate us, because we have been acting less than human. But Jesus has come to restore us, give us a purpose again, form us into his body, and ignite us and empower us to go and represent him well once again on the earth that he designed for us to steward. That's the good news. Jesus, the perfect human, is restoring our humanity, which was lost. See, the new creation that Jesus came to tell us about, the kingdom that was coming that Jesus came to tell us about, the new heavens that Jesus came to tell about, is a place and an experience in which our humanity will finally and fully and eternally be restored to us. By contrast, hell is a place where our humanity will be lost forever. And it is full of creatures that once were human, but now have no resemblance to the glorious creatures that they once were. So how do we understand humanity through Jesus? Every human being has infinite intrinsic value. It doesn't matter if they're rich or poor, clean or unclean, born or still in the womb, they are infinitely valuable, and it matters how we treat them because they are image bearers of God, whether or not they're doing a good job. Be careful how you treat the image of God. C.S. Lewis makes this profound and powerful statement, saying, "Remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or other of these destinations." Humanity is meant to be glorious and amazing, and Jesus is restoring that in us. The opposite is a complete loss of humanity, the worst thing you've ever seen. And what this is saying, what Lewis is saying, and what I believe Jesus has done, is he's invited us into the process and into the mission of helping people restore their humanity. And we can either do that or participate in the loss of humanity. Thirdly, Jesus helps us see the world because he's the Father's agent in creation and redemption. Verse 16 says, "In him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him." In verse 20, this is an intentional pairing of verses talking about creation and then redemption. Verse 20, "And through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on a cross." So Jesus is creator, creation fell, now he is redeemer. The Message version in verse 20 says, "All the broken and dislocated pieces of the universe, people and things, animals and atoms, get properly fixed and fit together in vibrant harmonies, all because of his death, his blood that poured down from the cross." There's an interesting connection between this Colossians passage and Genesis 1:1, "In the beginning God created," and then Proverbs 8, which talks about wisdom. There's original language, the words there connect to each other, and in the 1920s, a scholar named C.F. Barney suggested that this poem is intentionally meant to connect to the concept of wisdom in Proverbs 8 and creation in Genesis 1, right? So that Jesus is connected to this pre-existent wisdom that existed before God created, and it was through wisdom that God created the whole world. And then we read in 1 Corinthians 1:24 that Christ is the wisdom of God. So all this just to say, these connections are being made to say that it is through wisdom, through Christ, that God created the world wisely, and if we are called to be image bearers, representatives of God who wisely steward and lead and rule, what do we need? Wisdom. We need God's wisdom. We need to be filled with his wisdom in order to be who God has called us to be on this planet. So God creates and then humanity falls, and what he does is he calls one man, Abraham, and through Abraham, he has a nation, Israel, come forth. And he says, "You guys are going to represent me as my special people, my special possession. You will be the version of humanity that I want the whole world to see. You're going to be the light of the world. You're going to be my son." There's language of them being the son and his image there. And then Jesus comes out of Israel to be the true Israelite, the true representative to fulfill everything God called Israel to be. And through Jesus, we see what humanity is supposed to look like, what God's image is supposed to look like, and now we have all been invited to be a part of that, that Jesus represents now all of us, Jew and Gentile alike. And we need wisdom. God in creation did it through wisdom. In redemption, he did it through his son. In wisdom, what do you think we need in our marriages? What do you think we need in the church? What do you think we need in government? What do you think we need in our workplace? We need the wisdom of God, the creative, redemptive wisdom of God that will enable us to continue the mission that he called us to do, to be humanity, to be the image of God, to represent him and be
wise on this planet. Jesus comes as the true embodiment of what it means to be human, the true embodiment of what it means to be God's representative on earth, to fulfill his command to be faithful and fruitful and to rule wisely. So how do we understand the world through Jesus? Well, God created the world and said it was good. And even though the world became corrupted through sin, he has not given up on the world. He's not crumpling it up and throwing it in the trash can. He is redeeming and recreating, and he's doing it through the redemptive work of Jesus and through the redemptive work of his people joining on Jesus' mission. And we need his wisdom to be a part of that. Let's conclude with reading the last couple verses that we have assigned for this morning, verse 21 to 23. Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior. But now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation. In other words, he's giving you your humanity back. Verse 23, if you continue in your faith, established and firm, and do not move from the hope held out in the gospel, he's saying, keep your roots down deep. This is what God is doing in you, in the church. He is giving you humanity back. He's restoring the image of God in you. Keep yourself rooted in Christ while he does it, so you don't miss out and lose out on what he's doing. This is the gospel that you heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant. He's saying, this is the gospel. This is the good news proclaimed to all creation. God is setting things back in order. God is making a new heaven, a new earth. You are a new creation. You represent the new humanity, and you are being put back into your rightful place as an image bearer. Verse 21 in the message says, you yourself are a case study of what he does. The church is a case study of what God can do. So that the world, when the world sees the church, they say, God is good. He does good work. That's what we are meant to be. Jesus came to heal us, to restore our image, to make us more human in order to join his mission of redeeming creation. You are an image bearer of God. You know, Jesus in Matthew 22 was being questioned and tested. And someone came to him and said, Jesus, is it proper to pay taxes to Caesar? And this was a trick question because there was a debate in that time. Rome was oppressing Israel. Israel wanted to be independent from Rome. And Rome was taking tax from the people. They didn't want to pay it, but they knew if they didn't pay it, Rome would come in and destroy them. And if they did pay it, they were kind of traitors because Israel was supposed to be powerful on their own. So if Jesus said, yes, pay taxes, he would have been a traitor. If he said, no, pay taxes, he would have been a subversive and Rome would have come and dealt with him. So they were trying to trap him, but Jesus, in his wisdom, answered differently. And he said, give me a coin. And he held out the coin and he said, whose image is on this? And the answer was Caesar's. So he said, then give to Caesar what's Caesar's, but give to God what is God's. Now the man left, but there's a question that begs to be asked. Well, what is God's? And Jesus probably would have said this, whose image is on you? Whose image is on you? For some of us, it's time to recognize whose we are, how we're made, what our purpose is. It's time to give ourselves to the one who created us, the one who saved us and redeemed us, and just get on with it.